The Public Safety Committee will come to order, members. People are sort of drifting in, but we have a quorum, so if someone would take a look at the minutes, who's read the minutes, make a motion to approve the minutes of January 30th, I'd appreciate it.
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair. I found them fascinating. Thank you.
Representative Kiefer is moving the fascinating minutes from January 30th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? That motion prevails. The agenda for today was we are going to have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission make a report here at some point, and those of you who are on the Judiciary Committee have probably already seen their report, but not everyone serves on that committee. But obviously, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has a lot to do with bed impact, which is something we're obviously concerned about relative to the population at the Department of Corrections. But today we wanted to spend a little time looking at racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And Mark Hasse is here with a number of guests that will walk us through this, and feel free to ask questions. So, Mr. Hasse, do you want to just sort of introduce, get the ball rolling here, and then we can take it from there?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for having us here today to discuss this important issue. As Chair Paymar said, my name is Mark Hasse. I'm the Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice. The Council is a Minneapolis-based nonprofit that began in 1957, and our mission is to build community capacity to address the causes and consequences of crime through research, demonstration, and advocacy. Basically, what that means is we have direct service and programs for both offenders. We work in the prisons doing parenting classes and working with families. We also have programs that work with victims of crime. We do research. And we take the experiences and the information we get through our research and working in direct service and try to make our justice system better so that that Minnesota is a safer, stronger, and more just place for us all to live. In recent history, we've conducted a number of extensive research studies into racial disparities in the criminal justice system in Minnesota. Our research director, Ebony Ruland, is going to give you a quick overview of those. And then Professor Richard Fraze, professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, who is nationally known for his research in this area, is going to update you on some of his research and some specific issues. And then we're going to have somebody speak about a more of a courtroom perspective, and then I'll follow up with some ideas for possible policy reform.
Very
good. With
that,
I'll turn it over to Ms. Ruland.
Thank you. Ms. Ruland, welcome to the committee. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Ebony Ruland, and I am the research director at the Council on Crime and Justice. And I'm here this morning just to talk briefly about the Council on Crime and Justice's Racial Disparities Initiative. The Racial Disparities Initiative was launched in 2000, and it spanned from 2000 to 2006. And under the Racial Disparities Initiative, 17 studies were conducted that looked at the causes and consequences of racial disparities in the criminal justice system in Minnesota. And through the Racial Disparities Initiative, we were focused on two categories. First, we were interested in defining the disparity, so understanding the magnitude and the prevalence of disparities in the criminal justice system. And the second aspect of that was to look at the collateral effects, so looking at how racial disparities in the criminal justice system impacts families, individuals, and communities. So why did we do RDI, or the Racial Disparities Initiative? We did the Racial Disparities Initiative because racial disparities exist at almost every point at the criminal justice system. They exist in traffic stops and searches, they exist in arrests, convictions, and then incarceration. We did the Racial Disparities Initiative because at the time in 2000, in the early 2000s, Minnesota's racial disparities was more than twice the national average. Minnesota's black to white imprisonment ratio was the 12th highest in the nation. And changes within the criminal justice system, such as the war on drugs, stronger sentencing guidelines, impacted racial disparities. Here's some examples of the studies that were conducted under the Racial Disparities Initiative. We did a statewide racial profiling study that included several jurisdictions throughout the state of Minnesota that collected traffic stops and search data, along with the racial data of the person being stopped. We conducted a Minnesota police ethnography study, so we were with the Minneapolis Police Department for over 2 years, completing ride-alongs with them, attending their meetings, and looking at their arrest data, traffic stops and arrest data. We did a low-level offense study in Minneapolis where we looked at low-level offenses, arrests, and compared that by racial categories. And then we also did some juvenile work as well. So 13 studies were conducted that looked at defining the disparity. And 4 studies were looked at for the collateral effects. So we interviewed children who had a parent in prison under the collateral effects study. And we also interviewed recently released fathers. So some brief RDI findings. We found that the disparity is often generated at the first point of contact with law enforcement. And individuals are disproportionately likely to encounter the justice system as a result of geographical hotspots and school referral practices. So Minneapolis police have this policy called Code 4. And it's what that does is they put all their resources into, for instance, North Minneapolis. And they use Code 4 policies to look for pre-contextual stops in hopes to find bigger things like drugs in the car or what have you. So we found that through those policies and practices, they can lead to greater racial disparities within the criminal justice system. We also found that schools use, instead of dealing with disciplinary actions within the school, referring them to the county attorney's office or the courts also increases racial disparities. Through the racial disparities studies, we found that 37% of all vehicle traffic stops are of African Americans, yet African Americans comprise only 18% of the population. So again, a disparity is occurring in arrests. And I should also mention that through that study, through the statewide traffic stop study, we found that African Americans were searched more often but found contraband less than Caucasians. The collateral effects of racial disparities, so having these interactions or encounters with the criminal justice system creates long-lasting barriers that impact housing and employment. And then there's also the collateral effects that reach beyond the individual and go into the family as well. So that's all I have.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any questions? Ms. Ruland. Just a moment. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, a couple of questions. I guess really, what is your budget and how many employees does your agency have?
Our
Ms. Ruland.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Our budget is. Go ahead.
I'm Pam Alexander. I'm the president of the Council on Crime and Justice. Our budget is about $1.5 million, and we have 13 employees.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Representative Uglum.
You know, I wasn't around when this thing was set up and everything else, but do you have like a sunset clause at all for your agency? I mean, is it going to continue after your good work is done, or? Or what?
We're not a government.
Ms. Alexander, we're going to have to go through the chair here just to, because we're putting all of this on the record. But thank you, Judge, for coming.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
I have to learn the protocol. We don't get to come off it. Chair Paymar, I'm.
Thank you. Apologize. And welcome to the committee.
We're not a government agency. We're a nonprofit, a small nonprofit agency.
Okay.
So.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will we get a copy of your slides and some of the data of what you actually found from the study? That certainly would be nice to have.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, and to both of you, thank you for doing your presentation. Well, I'm curious, you gave up statewide data. The only agency you talked about was Minneapolis. How many other agencies were involved, and where were they? I'd be curious about that particular information.
Ms. Ruland, do you want to answer that now, or do you have the information? Okay.
I believe 46 jurisdictions throughout the state of Minnesota participated in the Minnesota traffic stop study. So it was both in the metro area and greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, is that data, do you have a much more comprehensive piece of data? Because that would answer a lot of questions for me. And you talked about Code 4 and the targeted resources. And, why is it targeted? What is happening, or what do they use? I mean, why do they move into a certain neighborhood, or what? Why,
Ms. Rulin?
They move it so it's based on statistical data. So they're using 911 calls and then other data to determine where they place resources. So the problem isn't so much that they're saturating an area with resources, because that's where the data is showing them where to go. The problem is using those pre-contextual stops, so waiting for someone to do a no turn on red or not use their signal in hopes of finding to do a search. That's the problem.
Thank you.
Okay. Judge Alex, one more. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to first of all say I'm sorry you really have to study this. You know, I wish this data wasn't here. State-by-state comparisons, because I've lived in a lot of different states in my life, and I know that demographics are different. And so do you have, like, some data from Georgia, for example, that would have similar numbers or different? And is this something that Minnesotans in general just need to, you know, get a broader perspective of things? Thank you.
Ms. Rulon.
Yes, the Council on Crime and Justice does have national comparisons, particularly when we look at incarceration rates. And I believe Professor Fraze, who's coming up next, will be able to talk about the national lens more.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's okay.
I did not vote for mandatory seatbelts. Do you know if mandatory seatbelts as a primary stop, a reason to a primary offense, has made the issue worse or better?
Ms. Rulon.
That I don't know. Sorry. I couldn't say for sure.
Representative Mueller, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know that some cops believe that it has been used actually more for a reason like that. But there's I don't know of any scientific knowledge on that issue. I did also want to make a comment on the saturation areas and whether there's discrimination in stopping. And I think I can pretty well testify that I don't see discrimination in stopping, because it depends on where I am in my district as to whether I get stopped for just like dirt on the license plate or a dusty license plate or things like that. So there's unquestionably more stops occurring in these targeted areas where there's high crime areas. But I don't, and other people that are friends of mine, people of color, don't think that it's on a racial basis, the stop. A lot of people do want stops of both races there, because we are very heavily hit with crime. And I don't know if there's if you have real statistics that show that that there's discrimination in that, because I know that white people sure get stopped a lot there for seemingly whether you're weaving on the street or whatever, claim to be weaving or just about anything. So, for instance, the same African American kids I talk to, they will tell me that if they're in one part of North Minneapolis, they will just get stopped, and that same cop won't stop them in another part. I think the police are pushed to be looking into things in very high crime areas, and I'm not an expert on the police, but those, they now have what they call hot zones the last few years, and I think they really concentrate on just about anybody doing anything in those places.
Was that, did you have a question or just
make a comment? I didn't. No. Okay.
Judge Alexander, welcome to the committee. Did you have some remarks you wanted to make?
I'm going to make my remarks later.
Okay. Okay, so you wanted to clarify the status of the organization. Okay. So, Mr. Hasse, then, who is next? Ms. Rulin, thank you for your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the committee. Just a couple of words about my background. I've been a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School since 1977. I teach entirely in the criminal law area, both academic courses and in clinical courses, clinics both in prosecution and defense. My principal research interests are in sentencing policy and particularly sentencing guidelines with an emphasis on Minnesota sentencing guidelines.
Before you begin, so it's Frasi, is that
Fraze.
It's Richard Fraze. Just for the record, we have that down. Fraze.
I'm going to address two related issues of Minnesota sentencing. So my focus is going to be sort of toward the end of the process, even though obviously racial disparities can and do arise at all steps of the process. The two issues are criminal history enhancements and racial disparities. And I'll state my conclusions up front and then explain them. First, these two issues are related because criminal history enhancements have a strong racially disparate impact. Secondly, that disparate impact could be reduced in ways consistent with public safety. And third, the changes needed to reduce that impact consistent with public safety might very well also save the state quite a bit of money. So first, what do I mean by criminal history enhancements? Criminal history means an offender's prior conviction record. And there are two ways in which that can affect the recommended sentence under the guidelines or the sentence the judge has to impose. The guidelines, like all guidelines, have a so-called criminal history score. You've seen the Minnesota sentencing guidelines grid, which is similar, typical. It has offense severity running on a vertical axis and criminal history score running across, and a matrix in which there are cells defined by severity of offense and degree of criminal history. And that's the recommended sentence, both as to duration of prison and as to whether you're recommended to go to prison right now with an executed sentence or whether you get a recommended suspended sentence of probation. So that's one kind of enhancement, criminal history score. The other kind of enhancement for criminal history is where a mandatory minimum statute is triggered by a prior conviction record and then directs the court with no discretion to sentence the offender to at least that long in prison. Now, the criminal history enhancements under the guidelines can be quite extensive. On the average, on the main guidelines grid for non-sex crimes, an offender in the highest criminal history category is on average recommended to receive a prison sentence twice as long as a first offender. For some crimes, it's three times as long. On the sex offender grid, the average is close to 4-1. And again, as I said, mandatory minimum statutes can also be based on prior conviction record. So that's what I mean by criminal history enhancements. Now, these enhancements, as I said, have a strong disparate impact on non-white offenders, especially African Americans and Native American offenders. And that disparate impact is one of the major reasons why, as was said by Ms. Ruland, Minnesota has above average disparities in its prison and jail populations compared to other states. I'm going to focus the remainder of my comments on African-American offenders. They're the largest non-white group. Their most research has been done about them. But much of what I'm going to say would also apply to African-American offenders. Every year in Minnesota, a considerably higher proportion of African-American offenders have recommended executed prison sentences with a longer average duration because of their prior conviction record. So, for example, in 2011, 28% of white offenders were recommended for immediate executed prison, 42% of African-American offenders. And that was, some of that difference is caused by African-American offenders being convicted of more serious crimes for which the guidelines require sentencing even for a first offender. But about two-thirds of the higher African-American recommended prison rate is caused by criminal history enhancements, either the criminal history score or a mandatory minimum. As a result, you have lots of African-American offenders being recommended to and sentenced to prison for medium and low-severity crimes, which would otherwise, were it not for their prior record, result in a suspended sentence and probation. So, what can we do about these disparities? I believe we can reduce them in ways consistent with safety. Why would we even use criminal history enhancements? So we have to sort of back up and say, why is this a major sentencing factor along with the severity of the conviction offense? The most plausible rationale for these enhancements is public safety, and based on the assumption that an offender with a higher record, a longer record of prior convictions, is more likely to commit further crimes. And that's certainly, there's a lot of basis for that in research. Criminological research in Minnesota, in other states, in every system that's ever been studied, to my knowledge, finds that, on average, an offender with a longer prior conviction record, more extensive record, is more likely, once released, to be rearrested for a new and reconvicted for a new offense. But that research also shows there's a number of other factors unrelated to criminal history which are also related to future offending risk. And one of the most important of those factors is age. It's so important that criminologists have given it a separate term, the age crime curve. And what they find is that offending rates, especially rates of violence, tend to peak in the 20s and 30s. And then when offenders get older, those rates decline. And this, some of this research has been done in Minnesota. In January of 1997, the Minnesota Legislative Auditor released a report entitled Recidivism of Adult Felons. One of the things they looked at over 8,000 Minnesota felons who had been released on probation or after a prison term in 1992, and they tracked them for 3 years, 5 years, something like that. And they found that offenders in their 40s and 50s were much less likely to be arrested and reconvicted than younger offenders. And yet, those older offenders, many of them are recommended to receive lengthy prison terms because of their prior records. Almost by definition, the offenders with the longest criminal history scores are going to be older offenders. So what this means is that criminal history enhancements are tending to give the more severe sentences to many offenders whose criminal careers are winding down or even finished. So how many older offenders are we talking about? If you look at the two most recent years of sentencing data in Minnesota, about 1,000 offenders each year aged 40 or older are being sentenced to prison. And about three-quarters of those, 750 offenders each year, were convicted of medium or low-severity crimes. Crimes that do not lead to a prison sentence except for criminal history enhancements. So that's a lot of offenders and a lot of prison deaths. In fact, if they each served a sentence of 2 years, that would be double the number of prison deaths, 1,500 prison deaths. And the failure to adjust for offender age is only one way in which criminal history enhancements have a disparate impact but fail to efficiently identify high-risk offenders. None of the components of the current guidelines criminal history score has ever been validated for risk. It was all done sort of intuitively. And Minnesota's not alone. No state has really validated its criminal history scores for risk assessment in order to say are these sentencing enhancements and these prison beds and this cost justified by public safety, by a higher risk of this offender? We need to do that research. The Minnesota Guidelines Commission is the perfect agency to do that. That's why we have a commission with data, with people who understand the data, and people who can help us better understand how to spend our resources wisely. So we need to particularly look at whether there are some components of the criminal history score that do not add any predictive value. I think it's quite possible some of the components of that score could be given less weight or even dropped entirely. For example, some research shows that the number of prior drug convictions does not, as it increases, does not increase the risk of further violence. It might increase the risk of further drug crime, but it doesn't increase the risk of further violence. Another example, there's good reason to think that offenders whose prior convictions are of a different type than the current crime are not as likely to commit this new crime again. And yet the current criminal history scoring takes no account of the similarity of past crimes and the current crime, or the spacing of the crimes. Are they all in the last couple of years, or were they spaced out over 15 years? We look back 15 years in Minnesota for prior convictions. Some of those old convictions probably have no predictive value in terms of risk. So anyway, putting it all together, it leads to the conclusion we should study these enhancements and adjust the enhancements so as to more efficiently identify risk and stop locking up a lot of lower-risk offenders, disproportionately non-white offenders. This would allow us to more efficiently pursue public safety. It could very well improve public safety, and it might even reduce cost if we're just not sending as many low-risk offenders to prison. Thank you.
So a couple questions. I have one first, but I just wanted to know so if we abandon the criminal history score, and I think we should have had the grid here for you, but I apologize.
Sorry, I didn't realize that we had possible.
No, I should have organized this better. But we'll have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission here, and we'll do a whole overview of all of this. But maybe you can just, if I missed something, what was the evolution of the criminal history score? Why we did that, and maybe Mr. Stewart or someone from Sentencing Guidelines can tell us more about that. And then, are you suggesting we abandon that? And what? You're not, because or adapting it, or replacing it, or reforming it. What are you?
So the history was just that the legislature directed the commission to propose guidelines based on reasonable offense and offender characteristics, and taking into substantial consideration prior practices as well as existing resources. So the commission looked at what explained prior judicial decisions and paroling decisions, and both of those decisions were based on the two factors, severity of the conviction offense, extent of the prior criminal record. Then, of course, they had to say, well, how are we going to score criminal history? And that they did, I think, pretty much on an intuitive basis. But all guidelines commissions did that. And it was partly that they bought into this 1970s theory of just deserts. So they were thinking, well, a person with a prior conviction record just deserves more punishment, and this is our feeling for how much more punishment they deserve. Now, people who study just deserts philosophy are in total disagreement about all of those issues. And I think, as I said in my comments, the most plausible rationale for those enhancements is public safety. And therefore, we need to validate criminal history enhancements for risk prediction ability. So, yes, I don't want to eliminate criminal history enhancements. I just want to refine them so that they more efficiently target higher risk offenders.
Very good. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I have so many questions. Don't you think, or maybe I guess I think, that at some point, once you get up into the higher criminal history range, that it is a legitimate public policy to say, clearly these folks are not going to remain law-abiding, and while it may not be a criminal, it may not be a public safety risk on whether or not this person goes to prison, but at some point, if you have just straight drug offenses, you get a half a point apiece. In order to get into the prison grid range, you can commit 12 felony convictions for drugs before going to prison unless you get probation violations sent to prison. Don't you think at some point it's a legitimate public policy to say clearly they are not going to remain law-abiding, and the state maybe should just lock them up because they are not going to remain law-abiding?
Mr. Fraze.
I guess I would say it's an empirical question. Some of those people may have committed those crimes many years ago. They may have gotten treatment. It may not be a fair statement of what they're going to do right now, especially if they're older. But I would agree, there are certainly some people who just don't get it. They will never get it. They'll keep doing it. Those are the people we definitely want to lock up, especially if they're going to commit violent crimes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does anyone in the country validate their sentencing guideline grid based on age?
Mr. Fraze.
Age?
Age. That's the factor you were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Fraze.
It is at least an indirect factor in a few guideline systems, but most of them don't look at that, which I just think is remarkable. And I've asked criminologists who study what's called criminal careers or life course criminology, have you ever put that together in the age crime curve with criminal history enhancements? And they say, oh, no, huh. I think it's remarkable. And one of the things that we're trying to do at the law school and an institute that we have is to encourage guidelines commissions, especially around the country, to take a look at these criminal history scores and these enhancements, which they really just have done intuitively, and really haven't done it in any evidence-based way.
Representative Hillstrom, before you ask your next question, would people please power down their phones totally, not just witnesses, audience? Please turn off your cell phones, please, because we'll never hear this.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, mine might be causing it, but I have the grid up on my iPad, so I am using it for...
That was my fault for not passing the grid out, but...
For work, Mr. Chair.
I suppose we have the grid around anywhere that we could make copies of real quickly. Well, besides on your... All right, well...
Mr. Chair, my question is, do we know, based on research, where the disparity really comes into play? We know that the criminal history score really enhances that. But in the grid, these are your low-level offenses down at the bottom, you'll all see. And then as you move up the grid, these get to be more and more severe crimes. So do we know, does the real disparity come on these low-level drug crimes? Does it come in the middle where there are things like auto theft and burglaries? Or does it come at the top in the violent crime area? I mean, do we really know where in...
Continue, Representative Hillstrom, with your question.
Thank you. So do we know where along the grid that these happen? And even if we accounted for age, do we believe that it would make a difference in the disparity piece based on who's in prison?
Mr. Fraze.
I haven't looked specifically at age versus race issues. I guess I used age as an example of something that we ought to be that would more efficiently predict risk. I guess I'm willing to hypothesize anyway that given that non-white offenders on average have higher prior conviction records and that you need to be to have a higher criminal history score, that many of those non-white offenders who are getting pushed across the grid into the recommended prison zone are not only non-white but older, but that's an empirical question. I think what we ought to be trying to do and what we can do with a guideline system is have more evidence-based sentencing policy that actually looks at what are we accomplishing here and what is it causing.
Mr. Hillstrom, we have a number of other people who have questions you want.
I'll ask more later, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. Sentencing guidelines is in my committee jurisdiction, Mr. Chair, so I'll have plenty of time to talk about sentencing guidelines.
And also, you can turn your machine off. We're getting copies of the grid so we can everyone will have copies.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Schoen, Mullery, Neuberger, and Simon in that order.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fraze. Could you provide me an example of what you determine as medium and low severity crimes? And I ask you to do that outside of personal consumption drug possession.
I was referring again to the grid, and so if you can all sort of visualize that gray area toward the bottom of the grid, Above the top of that gray area are the crimes beginning at severity level 8 of the guidelines, where I call those high severity crimes, where the offender is recommended for an executed prison sentence no matter what their criminal history score. So these are things like, you know, armed robbery, first and second degree criminal sexual conduct, aggravated assault, obviously manslaughter, murder. So those are what I'm calling the high severity crimes. Medium and low severity are the ones that have at least part of their line of the grid in the gray area. That's what I'm calling medium and low.
And Mr. Chair, that was Sean.
So I'm asking you to give the public and me examples of what are considered medium and low severity. And I'll give you a disclaimer. I've been a police officer for 11 years, worked narcotics and violent crimes, and it's interesting when you look at the level and say we've got this is a part one crime, exactly what you're talking about, homicide, criminal sexual conduct, aggravated robbery, and then the things that fit what the sentencing guidelines are medium and low severity. However, if it happens upon you and your family, it's not so medium and low severity. And then I'll make one more comment, is that many of the crimes that people are convicted for and receive their points for are not exactly the true whole story for society. And that I think that's just a very important piece, that when somebody gets sentenced for one particular crime, it's many times that as a result of a plea bargain through our justice system that they were basically allowed to drop several other charges that were fairly serious as well to receive that sentence for one. But what is it that is your assumption of a medium to low severity crime?
Well, Mr. Fray,
what you're looking at? Can you, give me that list? Sorry.
We need to go. The only reason we're doing this is that for the tape, but we have to just go through the chair so we know that it's you speaking.
Again, I'm just using terms based on the structure of the grid. So in the areas of the grid, the middle and low part of the grid that I was referring to, those are many of them are property crimes. Almost all theft crimes are there. I think almost all burglary crimes are there. As you said, many drug crimes are there, fraud crimes, just a wide variety of mostly non predominantly non-violent crimes, although obviously any of those crimes has a potential for violence. And as you point out, plea bargaining means that the crime of conviction is often not the real offense. But every guideline system except the federal guidelines bases the sentence on the actual conviction offense rather than the so-called real offense. Federal guidelines try to say, oh, no, you can be convicted of this crime down here, but we're going to sentence you for this much more severe crime that you really did. That's one of the reasons the federal guidelines are so unpopular, because they really don't respect the formalities of what you were convicted of. But I agree, that's fine.
Representative Sean?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you. I mean, I'm always looking for ways to improve our criminal justice system from top to bottom, so thank you.
To this point, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a point. Under Minnesota statute, we do define auto theft as a crime of violence for the purpose of whether or not you can be convicted of a felon in possession of a handgun. And so some of those medium-level severities we do define in statute as crimes of violence. So I just want to make that clear that these are not all just property crimes under Minnesota statute.
Very good. Representative Mullery is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the age issue because since I've come here, I've seen people put in continually extensions like, we'll make a 25-year crime a 35-year, or 25-year sentence a 35-year sentence for the, or 40 years to 50 years. And I'm wondering if that shows, other than keeping everybody, I mean, if we took the position that everybody that's ever committed a crime is a danger for the rest of their life, are we achieving much monetarily by those kinds of extensions of sentences? It would seem that somebody who has committed one crime unless it's part of a business type of, you know, shaking down people or shooting people to make sure that they pay you, others pay you or something. Is there any studies on that, the value of it? One other thing I was wondering about, I think the public really, so that would be the first question, a little bit different, well, very different, would be, do you know of any studies on sentencing between whites and blacks on burglary in the same area, how the sentences come out on something like that?
Mr. Price?
Mr. Price? If I understood your first question, it was whether increased sentencing severity helps to control crime better than a lower sentence, just as a general matter, or was it particular kinds of sentence increases you were interested in?
Would be more, Mallory. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fraze. Often one incident crime or something, a severe crime, how much safety are we getting to the public by putting them in, changing it from 30 to 40 years or something like that? For the reason you're talking about, a person of 20 is more likely to be out of control or something.
Yeah, so
Mr. Fraze.
Mr. Chair, so there's two ways in which increasing sentencing severity, longer prison sentence, could help control crime. One is to what we call deterrence. People see that more severe sentence and they say, I don't want to get that. I'm not going to do that crime. Or even this offender thinks, well, I'm not going to do it again because look how severely I was punished this time. Generally speaking, I mean, we all don't park illegally because we don't want to get a ticket. Certainly deterrence works for some crimes and some people. But in general, criminologists find that it's very difficult to show any increased deterrent effect by increasing sentencing severity. And a major reason for that is most crimes are not committed by people who are thinking ahead too much. They're thinking about the moment. They're thinking about what they want right now. So it's very hard to demonstrate for most crimes and most offenders much of a deterrent effect by increasing penalties, especially when the penalties are already very severe. What is another, 5 years on top of that? Yeah, they hope they aren't going to get caught in the first place. And incapacitation of dangerous people is the other rationale. We just simply put this person off the street so they can't commit any crimes. Now, that presupposes that this person is going to commit more crimes, but the older they are, the less likely that is, especially as to violence. There's also, for some crimes, what's called the replacement effect. People are locked up, somebody else takes their place, selling drugs in particular. So that you don't get much incapacitation value by locking up people who are quickly replaced. And some people we know are made worse in prison. Their life chances, their ability to get a job, to get married, to have a stable lifestyle, is not improved by a lengthy period in prison. So anyway, the short answer is, for reasons of the age crime curve, but also other reasons, increasing the criminological research tends to show pretty consistently that increased sentencing severity doesn't buy you that much. Probably buys you something. There have to be some people who don't commit crimes because they're locked up. But, in this business, resources are not free. And prison is expensive. There are a lot of other things we want to spend public resources on. We don't want to raise taxes. So we have to make those hard choices. And that's one of the reasons, one of the things a guideline system allows us to do is to cost these things upfront and set those priorities.
Mr. Fraze, I wonder, now that we have a copy of the sentencing guidelines grid, do you want to, I'd like someone just to explain this to the committee in 2 or 3 minutes. We can have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission do it, or if you feel like you can, explain it real quickly.
Okay, so again, the two major dimensions of the decision are offense severity, that's the vertical dimension, where we look and see what severity level this conviction offense, most serious conviction offense, is on. So if you're convicted of armed robbery, I think that puts you in level 8. First degree aggravated robbery,
And then we look at the other dimension, the criminal history dimension, and we see what column are you in based on your criminal history score, which runs from 0 to 6. At some point, it's capped. We don't keep increasing the recommended sentence beyond a certain point. The reason for that is we want sentences to be at least roughly proportionate to the seriousness of the crime. We kept increasing sentencing recommendations as criminal history just kept getting higher and higher. People convicted of a relatively low severity crime could get a sentence much more severe than somebody who committed a much more serious crime. So it's capped at 6 or more criminal history points. So that system then defines what box, what cell of the grid you're in. And in that cell, there is either a single number at the bottom of the grid or a range in the white cells. And so the range says this is the range within which of prison months in prison that a judge could select without it be considered departure from the guidelines. The single number in the cells in the gray zone says this is the recommended suspended prison sentence. These are people who are recommended for probation unless that is trumped by a mandatory minimum statute. And that number in there, 18, let's say 18 months, is the recommended duration of suspended prison sentence. Put them on probation, 18 months is hanging over their head. If they fail on probation badly enough, we execute the 18-month sentence. Now they go to prison.
Okay. Other questions on the grid? Did that explain things? Okay. Now we have that. Representative Neuberger, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to preface all this. I want to say thank you to the folks that have come out here today, to Ms. Ruland and Professor Frazee and the Honorable Alexander. Thank you. The point I want to try to make here today is I need to be full disclosure as well to the committee. I have a unique insight to all of this. I have been a full-time paramedic in North Minneapolis for the last 25 years. So when you talk about crime, I'm the guy that cleans up the mess. And I just want to, I'm a medical person, okay? And it appears that what we're trying to do is attack the symptom and not the cause. And I'm going to ask this question, perhaps one of you three could answer this, and this is a complex question, but what I see happening here, we have a breakdown of culture is what we have. We have the breakdown of the culture leads to the breakdown of the family. We have young people, as many folks here could probably testify, we have young people in these communities whose surrogate family becomes a gang. Okay, and we all know that the gang culture is one of crime. Sooner or later, gang involvement ends up in where? Prison. They go to prison. Who are they in prison with? Other gang members. What do they learn in prison? How to be better criminals. They get out. Who's their surrogate family? Their gang. What type of behavior do they get caught up in again? Gang-like activity. Repeat. Okay. When I hear about these guidelines and when I hear about all of the legalese and all of the technical things that we're talking about, when or what I feel we really need to be addressing is why are the family units breaking down in these communities? Why are these young people being forced to find surrogate families in gangs which perpetuate this problem? I think that once we can start addressing that issue, everything else will fall into line. I just needed to make that, and I wanted to address that. I know that this is a complex thing that we could probably spend the next 10 years talking about, but if we don't at least call attention to it, we're doing ourselves a disservice. So thank you.
Mr. Perez, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. The problems of crime and family breakdown and gangs and so on are obviously much broader than anything the criminal justice system
can deal with, although, and therefore, we need to sort of go upstream, in a sense, and figure out where are these problems coming from, because you can almost predict by zip code the odds that somebody, especially a young man, is going to end up in prison. And part of that is concentrations of race and poverty. And the question for the criminal justice system is, how can we at least not make those problems worse? And to the extent that we have a system that just keeps hammering the same people and hammering them harder and recycling them through the system and worsening their life chances, we may be making the problem worse. So we need to at least be aware of that. But you know, my research suggests that most of the disparities in the criminal justice system, in conviction rates, recommended, and prison populations, most of that is present at the front end, unfortunately. You see it in arrest figures, and those arrests are correlated with disadvantage. Minnesota has one of the highest rates of socioeconomic disparity, black, African-American versus white, in the country. And those things do generate crime, and the criminal justice system then just recycles that, worsens disadvantage, perpetuates it. So, yeah, we do need to be concerned about those broader issues, but we have to focus within the criminal justice system, what can we do better, or at least not make anything worse.
We have one more question, and then I think I'd like to ask Judge Alexander to come up for her presentation. Representative Simon.
Sure, thanks a lot. I'll try to be quick. Mr. Chair, Professor Fraze, welcome. I had you twice in law school for criminal law and criminal procedure. Good to see you. You had talked about what you called the just deserts theory. I think that some others would call it just rough justice or even punishment. And I don't think that's entirely irrelevant or unjustified. I think society does have certain subjective ideas about what it wants to do to send messages, even if the facts and the studies don't bear out a particular end result. I think it's not to be dismissed. I don't know that you were dismissing it, but it shouldn't be. But you did talk in response to Representative Mullery's question about general deterrence, and that you generally said that that you didn't find any sort of general deterrent to some of these sentences. But what about specific deterrence? What about specific offenders who maybe after one or two or three or four passes, basically, in the system, might curb certain violent or other behaviors? Can you generally talk about specific deterrence?
Mr. Fraze.
The research on specific deterrence, it's difficult to separate that out from the effects of incapacitation. Basically, what we want to know is, does giving this offender more punishment reduce their likelihood of committing further crimes? To some extent, that's achieved by them not being on the street. But generally, to the extent that research looks at deterrence, it tends to make the same conclusions about individual deterrence as general deterrence, in the sense that if it's difficult to get other would-be offenders to take this penalty seriously or an increased penalty seriously because they don't think they'll get caught, they're living in the moment, that's true of the individual as well. Now, it is true that you know, sometimes people see the light and they think, okay, you know, now you've hit me so hard, I'm gonna reassess. I guess I would say that the assumption of criminologists to study this would be that's more likely to happen just because they're getting older and they're getting tired of this. So even if you gave them the same penalty, at some point they can say, I just can't do this anymore. So the extra penalty and the extra cost of that penalty may not be buying us enough. So again, it's all a sort of what's a good buy? You pay more, are you getting more? How much more? But you know, certainly there are going to be some offenders who you hit them harder each time, and eventually you get their attention. But I don't think there's a whole lot of, in fact, I don't think there's really any research that would really validate that and say it's a goodbye. It certainly can happen. On the question of just deserts, and I think everyone agrees offenders need to be held accountable for what they've done. One of the ways we do that, one of the ways all modern systems do that, is through So the message we send, we are convicting you of this serious crime. We are also saying how serious it is by the length of the prison sentence, even if it's not executed right away. But that sends a message. You know, you got a 60-year prison sentence, a 60-month prison sentence, or a 48-month prison sentence. You know, even if you get probation and you only spend, say, a year in jail as a condition of probation, we've made the statement how serious that crime was. But we don't actually give people their full just deserts in most cases. And we couldn't afford it, and it wouldn't probably be the most efficient way to handle offenders. Suspended sentences, probation is widely used, but I do think it's important to hold them accountable and to make a statement of how serious their crime was. And eventually, in some of those cases, we're going to have to actually give them that executed sentence because they just don't work on probation.
Representative Simon. Okay, Mr. Hasse, do you? Who's next, and how do you want to do? We have a half hour left.
Oh, I originally thought we only had an hour, so I was just going to check in on time. So, yes, Judge Alexander was going to speak now.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I did want to reserve about a little bit of time to see if there's anyone from the audience who wants to testify at the end and make an announcement about next week's hearing. So, Judge Alexander, welcome to the committee again.
Representative Kamar, Mr. Chair. I know how to do it now. I just had to watch it. And thank you for having me and the members of my office here this afternoon. I am going to talk to you. Mark asked me to talk to you from the judge's perspective, but I'm going to put a disclaimer on that. I have not been a judge for 5 years now. I've been the president of the Council on Crime and Justice and have been working there, although I will be rejoining my colleagues in a month or so. So I will try to speak a little bit on their behalf and about the things that we've done in the court to look at racial disparities. I was part of the racial bias task force report that was commissioned by the Minnesota Supreme Court in the early 90s. And the chair of our task force was Justice Rosalie Ball. We did study a number of racial disparities issues and had hearings around the state to talk to people about issues that they had with the court system. I'm going to also say that we did only look at the court part. We did not look at how people got to court. We started from court through sentencing. So it was arraignment through sentencing is what the racial bias task force actually covered. The task force did find that there were disparities within the system and did make 87 recommendations to the court for implementation. I have been part of the committee to implement those 87 recommendations since then. So I've been hanging around for about 20 years trying to get some of these recommendations implemented. The task force did find that there was a what we perceived and called a funnel effect in terms of we looked at the court system as a funnel and people came in on the front end and what happened to them on the back end and who was at the back and who was at the front. And we did find that at every stage that there could be something that could happen that may be helpful. Communities of color were not able to take advantage of those as well as others. And so at the back end, there ended up being more people from communities of color in prison, even taking into consideration criminal history and severity of offense. So we wanted to look at why that happened and what we could do to alleviate that. As many of you know who were around during that time, the task force report was criticized to some degree because of the fact that we did not have a lot of raw data then. We've since collected a lot of that data, and the court itself did start to collect race data. We did not have data that was collected identifying people's races ever, and the court does collect that data now. There's only certain police departments actually that collect that as well and keep it in aggregate form. So we were able to start collecting race data to find out where the problems lied. We collected it with the SIP system and the TISA system, the prior system that the court has before now, which is the Mensa system that they have today, and I believe they are still collecting that data. If they're not, I'll be very upset because I worked on that for about 10 years. I was like, come on, guys, please collect it. So in order to look at the practices of what the judges were doing to see, in fact, if it was something that they were doing that was causing the disparities, and we did find that there were some issues. One of those issues was around bail and whether or not bail was being set in a racially neutral way. So we looked at implementing different types of bail instruments as a result of the Race Bias Task Force to make sure that we were using racially neutral factors rather than looking at race. And we did go around the country, because this was actually a nationwide movement, to look at bail and what was the risk of people being held pretrial. We did know that if you're held pretrial, you're more likely to be held post-trial. So people who make bail tend to stay out, and people who stay in tend to stay in. And so we didn't want the fact that you might have been poor or a person of color to then adversely affect whether or not what would happen to you as you move through the system. So we did look at bail, did redo our bail instruments based on that, looked at factors. We did find that we were taking into consideration factors that really had no impact on whether or not people came back to court. You would think that intuitively you would look at stuff like, you know, where do people live, do they have a job, that, those types of things. Well, we did, and we studied that, and we looked at it and found that really none of that had any predictive factor as to whether or not you came back to court. The one thing that we figured out that you could look at that would predict whether you would come back to court is if you didn't come back to court before. That was the biggest predictive factor. So people who were homeless or people who did not have a job but came to court always came to court for whatever reason. So we were able to find them, send them back to court. We also found that if you called them, they would remember and they'd come to court. That worked really well with juveniles as well, because you just call them and say, you got to go to court tomorrow, and they would.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you also take a look, for example, when you were looking at who got sent to prison and who didn't, access to things like treatment, pretrial, and who took advantage, and Rule 25, and, you know, funding availability based on geographic areas? Did you look at that at all?
Yeah, we did look.
Judge Alexander.
Representative Primar, Representative Hillstrom, we did look at that. Access to health care is, in terms of treatment, is a huge issue. Obviously, people who don't have health care, don't have money, can't avail themselves of those programs as much. There's always more need than there is availability. And so even when we looked at Rule 25s, we looked at, you know, who is looking, you know, who wants to go to treatment. There, people may want to go, but there may not be space for them, and they may not afford it. Obviously, private caregivers, if they have that availability, can really do a lot better. And we also found that in you know, all the DWI stuff, you'll find that people who have private insurance and can get their own thing going usually have better get lighter sentences and better outcomes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that that was the case, but did you see a racial difference in the availability of those services?
Yes,
Judge Alexander.
Representative Paymar, yes, Representative Hillstrom, we did, because people, the economic factors played heavily in terms of people who were poor.
Representative Mueller has a quick question here, and then we'll let you continue on with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. One sort of quite related to that question is, did you look at the mental health availability? Because we're finding that that's an enormous factor in this issue.
Yeah, Representative Mullery, the whole issue of untreated mental health among this population is extremely serious. It's serious for people who come into the jail system. It's serious all the way through. And I think we haven't addressed it as well as it should be addressed, and it needs to be looked at very, very closely. unmet mental health need is a huge, huge problem.
Go ahead. Please continue.
And we find it at every single solitary stage. The only place that we do a very good, a good job in terms of mental health assessment is with kids. So in juvenile court, we do a lot of mental health assessments, obviously because it's a treatment court and we want to treat kids, but we do not have that same availability in adult court.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know, I guess you're Judge Alexander and waiting for an hour or whatever. as you know from being on the bench, there's a huge difference in the charge that judges face and what they're given as compared to what the prosecutors have. When you did a study, were you able to look at the prosecutor's files too on the backgrounds? Because what they recommend, what their position is, often has an effect on your decisions too.
Judge Alexander.
Representative Paymar, Representative Mulery, I was a prosecutor. And so we did have, I was a defense attorney too, so I kind of wore both hats. But we are able to look at some things that the prosecutors have. The prosecutors they do quite well in terms of arguing about why they do particular things, as well as defense counsel. I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. They're advocates. And so we know that, you know, the judges are going to have to weigh what they see. In terms of seeing the entire prosecutorial file, no, we don't see that. But I can tell you through the 25 years that I was on the bench, you know, there are people that I knew a whole lot about because I saw some folks a lot. Then there were some folks I only saw one time. So you do get to know who your audience is and who we're dealing with. I think one of the biggest issues that I find to be problematic is the mental health issue. There's a lot of unmet mental health problems that may not get to the severity that it gets into our mental health court. So we have a kind of a gray area there where people who have issues that could be treated medically aren't getting the kinds of things that they need to then be able to return them to law-abiding behavior. So it is an unmet need that needs to be done, and there's a high level of depression and other issues among communities of color that have gone unmet for years.
Judge or Mr. Hasse, I mean, we're just cognizant of time here. Do we have some recommendations that you want to talk about, or do you have? Just trying to figure out what we're doing here for the last few minutes.
All right. I'm going to then turn it over to Mark, who does have some policy considerations we'd like you to think about.
Okay. I didn't want to cut you off if you had some other points.
It's absolutely fine, and I'm just happy that you are talking about these issues and that you are concerned. I did want to talk a little bit about collateral consequences, but I know that Mark will talk about that, or Mr. Hasse will talk about that, and I thank you for your time and your attention this morning.
Judge, why don't you stay there, and we'll just, Mr. Hasse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I stated earlier, what the Council on Crime and Justice does is we use our research and information we get from working directly with people impacted by these issues, communities, criminal justice stakeholders, and we come up with justice policy reforms that we think would help to address these issues. And I'm sure in your position you'd like to know what you can actually do about this. A couple of caveats. First of all, you know, we're talking about racial disparities here, but the policies that we propose will actually help all people in Minnesota. These issues impact people across the state. They may impact your family and friends at some point, as well as communities that have additional barriers around employment and housing and other issues that may lead into the criminal justice system and make recovering from, you know, living law-abiding and supporting their families and themselves can be difficult going forward. I also want to quickly just, you know, go back to Representative Neuberger's comment earlier that if you really want to do something about these issues, the better place to do it is in the Health and Human Services Committee or the Education Committee. And I think one of the reasons we're in the position we are now in Minnesota and across the country is too many people, legislators in particular, have thought that criminal justice committees could solve all these problems. And a lot of these problems that end up in the criminal justice system. Mental health, chemical dependency are better treated and taken care of in other places. So with that, just a few things that we would recommend. I think it bears noting Professor Fraze's comments. I think changing our sentencing guidelines would be a heavy lift. But I do think that his research is showing that that's something that the state should look at. Minnesota has been a leader in this type of work in the past, and just because other states haven't done this yet, I think it would be smart of Minnesota to revisit our sentencing guidelines using some of his information and see if there's things that can be improved. Also around sentencing, we do have some mandatory minimum sentences here in Minnesota that can catch people that if you were the judge in that case, you would not give them the sentence that the legislature has required them to give. You know, judges have a lot of experience and they can look at things on a case-by-case basis, and what mandatory minimum sentences do is they take that discretion away from the judge and they give a sentence that just doesn't make sense sometimes. And there's in particular, we have a mandatory minimum sentence related to possession of drugs where somebody who relapses may relapse in a fairly small way, but they can end up with a very long mandatory sentence that the judge has to follow. Along the area of collateral consequences, and this is where you'll see a lot of proposals coming before you this session and next session. And this is, again, going back to some of the comments that were made, one way to stop the cycle. If people can be successful, get employed, support their families and themselves, if they can get education, research has shown that they're less likely, and get married, research has shown they're less likely to commit crimes, as well as, you know, our state will be stronger economically and more just. One in particular is the issue of juvenile records. The Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee has their annual report, and in their report this year, based on our Minnesota statistics, they found out that African American youth in Minnesota are 6 times more likely to be arrested in the state of Minnesota. Some of these disparities are greater at the juvenile level. Now, again, this applies to all kids across the state. And the way the law works here in Minnesota is if you're charged with any felony level offense when you're 16 or 17, that's automatically a public hearing, and then a public record that follows this child for the rest of their life. When these court hearings were open in 1986, there may have been some good reasons to do that, but the entire lay of the land has changed since then. Now we have electronic access to these records, and we have parents and kids coming to us wondering why that this record is still following them years later. And that record, that charge is all that triggers the open hearing. If the charge is later dismissed or reduced, that charge of that felony offense is still a public record. We'd like to make it so judges can have some discretion in deciding if those records need to be public or not, and there'll be a bill coming out in that vein very soon. Another issue is employment. Making sure people can at least, you know, it's not, we don't want, a criminal record can be a factor to consider in employment. Employers should have some of that information. In 2009, Governor Pawlenty signed a law that requires all public employers in the state to wait until the interview stage to ask about records, sometimes called ban the box. We think that private employers could help out this situation by stepping up and doing the same in their employment throughout the state. There's issues around human services licensing. I'm not going to even go into that, but our statutes around whether people can get work in licensed employment like personal care assistants and nursing homes, one of our fastest growing sectors in the state, be a foster parent. A juvenile arrest can keep them from doing that for the rest of their lives under our current law, and so we're working to make some changes there. Another area is eventually getting a record sealed. In today's electronic age with the internet, truly minor convictions can follow somebody for life, and they have to continually answer for that. In employment and housing, going back to somebody for life, and they have to continually answer for that. In employment and housing, going back to the racial disparities, research has found that if you're a person of color, those are a greater burden to carry. There's ways in law through remedies like expungement that can be crafted in a safe way that can help people in that area. And the final one I want to mention is voting. The governor has looked at this in his election integrity task force. Just to note on the racial disparities in voting, in Minnesota, 1.7% of our entire voting age population is disenfranchised due to a felony conviction. 10% of the African American community is currently disenfranchised. 10% of the African American community if you look at African-American males who can vote, 17%, nearly one in five, cannot vote currently. And when you talk about the cycle and the impact this has on families, you know, think about a child who either goes with their parent to vote or is told that their parent can't vote. Aside from the racial disparities, what's happened in Minnesota across the country is the number of people that are impacted by these things has greatly increased. If you look at voting, in the last 30 years, the percentage of Minnesotans who cannot vote due to a felony conviction has increased by over 400% in the last 30 years. So a felony today doesn't mean what it meant years ago, and we think it makes sense for people who are living in the community, not in jail or prison, to be able to join the community fully and vote. And with that, I will conclude. Thank you.
And I want Mr. Stewart, if he from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, to quickly come down too, if you want. Do you have some comments to make, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment to Mr. Hazy that while you were talking about the mandatory minimums, you stated that it puts the judge in a position where they have to give a sentence that doesn't make sense. I just want to make it really clear that the judge always has the opportunity to downwardly depart. They just have to say why they did it. And so even with mandatory minimums, the judge doesn't have to give a sentence that doesn't make sense.
Okay, very good. Mr. Stewart, do you would you like to make I don't have a lot of time left, but Judge, did you want to respond to that? I didn't.
Generally, yes. Thank you, Representative Claymar. If the case is charged with a mandatory minimum and it is they plead guilty to that or are found guilty of that, that mandatory minimum has to be imposed. That's not something that can be departed from. The statutory minimum has to be imposed in all those cases, so you can't depart from that. You can depart for other on other types of cases, but not mandatory minimum cases. You all made that really hard.
Mr. Stewart, would you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I've been a public defender in Minnesota now for 35 years. I was a member of the Supreme Court Race Bias Task Force with Judge Alexander for 20 years. And I'm currently serving on the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, although I'm not speaking for the commission today. I'm just one person. But I would like to make a couple of observations. First of all, I agree with Ms. Ruland that the first point of contact is where an awful lot of the disparity gets into the system. 10 years ago, the legislature passed a bill directing the Department of Public Safety to collect data about race in traffic stops. And I don't know that anybody's ever gone back and analyzed what was learned and what training occurred and how that situation may have been improved over the last 10 years. And I think that would be worthwhile effort to have a look back and see how we're doing in the area of race and that first contact. Within the sentencing guideline system, although I don't think that the sentencing guidelines adds a lot of disparity into the system, there are some things that the guidelines could be used for to improve the situation. You could, the commission could, look at these pieces of criminal history. And I would just like to give one example to build on what Professor Fraze says. The drug sentences are very high in comparison to other states. In 07, the legislature directed the guidelines to consider changing the drug sentences, but this did not happen. Nevertheless, take a look at the way the criminal history score works. Let's say you have somebody that sells 10 grams of cocaine and they're a first offender. They're in the same box on the grid as somebody that commits first-degree manslaughter. Maybe that's a good idea, maybe it's not. I'm not claiming it's a good thing to sell cocaine, although I kind of believe that first-degree manslaughter is a lot worse. But that's not my point. My point is, let's say that individual had two or three prior convictions for check forgery, and they're on probation for check forgery, and now they get caught with drugs. they're going to get two or three or four more years in prison based on their criminal history, based on check forgery. Now, I'd like to ask Professor Fraze's question. Is that a good buy for you? Are you getting your money's worth on those extra years in prison that the drug offender is getting because they had a previous check forgery? That might not be a good bargain for the state of Minnesota to be giving that person those extra years. And that's the kind of thing that I think would be helpful to look at, is where is the criminal history score actually predicting a violent crime, and where are we just giving somebody more time without a lot of analysis behind it? Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. I see their questions. And I know you've got to get out of here in a few minutes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stewart, isn't drug crimes defined as violent crime under the definition of violent crime in the statute for felons in possession of a handgun?
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think it is. The initial focus of the guidelines, though, was what was called crimes against a person. And although an offense might be on the violent crime list, a person who has an illegal drug in their pocket, although they're not doing a good thing, they may not be committing an offense against a person. I have to say, I've had thousands of clients over the years. I really do not like violent crime. And I'm not here to ask you to let people that hurt other people out of prison. I'm suggesting that there might be some people who are going to prison who do not represent a risk of hurting other people. There, for instance, in Shakopee, there's 600 women in Shakopee prison right now. 200 of them are in there for drug crimes. I do not believe that they are all a danger to come out and hurt folks. A lot of them came in there on incidents where they were self-medicating after experiencing trauma, for instance. A lot of them are dealing with depression, and they're taking drugs that maybe they shouldn't take to try to help themselves, and they end up in state prison. You know, to me, if I may go on a second, the drug court report shows that there are some more cost-effective and capable ways of dealing with people who are addicted that don't involve as much expenditure of your prison dollars. So that's the kind of thing I hope the committee would look at.
Representative Cornish, Representative Hillstrom, I know you have more questions, but we're going to go a little bit over. Representative Schoen has a question also. We can have everyone come back, but I'd like just to, you know, we need to wrap up here pretty quick. Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll make mine brief. The traffic stop study that you referenced about the disparity in the traffic stops, I think that was a pretty bogus study. And my belief for that is I know the cop that was on that task force that did that, and he said that he believes that the people came to that council with a preconceived notion that there was biased stops. And he wrote a summary, and I made about 50 copies hoping to bring it out someday. And if we do restudy that, I'd like to get that officer down to tell him why he thought it was a rather bogus study. The other thing, and not that it say that it doesn't happen, but I rode with my son as a state trooper. The first two people we stopped at night happened to be black, and it was obvious traffic violations, and the first thing they said is, you stopped me because I'm black. Unfortunately, by all the attention we bring to it, in some ways, we're giving people that the first thing that comes out of their mouth, it seems like. So the other thing is, we're going to have a heck of a hard time changing prison sentences, because in my district, time after time after time in the media, when somebody is caught for something, they said, well, he was in court and he was sentenced for that, and he served 2 years. He was in court and he was served three more years. And people are asking me, why in the world is he getting out to recommit crimes? So we're going to have a real trouble with that. And then I think my partner over here, Officer Schoen, probably has some comments in the future about drug sentencing, where it appears that people are in prison for drugs. They're really not, because it's another offense and it's down to drugs. But I'll let him address that at another time.
Briefly, Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I'm actually not referring to the Council on Crime and Justice study on arrests. I just know there was a bill passed about 10 years ago, and I believe the Department of Public Safety was directed to collect a lot of data, and I don't know where that ever went. That was my point about that.
Representative Schoen and Neuberger, then we're going to adjourn.
Mr. Chair, and to everybody, thank you.
You know, I'm looking for data, and again, when I pointed out the data with the agencies that participated, and I know statewide we're talking, I'm curious about how that data relates county to county and the judicial system as well, and as far as the sentencing disparities, if that's related, because I'm only going to take a guess because I grew up in rural Minnesota, came here. Is it different in Candiahuy County or maybe Chippewa County as it is in Hennepin County as far as percentages, not numbers, because I realize the numbers are greater? And then I want to point out the fact on what you made the statement on the drug crimes related to Shakopee. I've been there, and I have yet to see anybody go to prison for a first-time drug offense. And that's an important piece of the – I mean, you don't go to state prison. You might end up in jail for the weekend, but I have not seen anybody imprisoned for drug possession.
Mr. Stewart? Mr. Chair, Representative Sean, I think that's a good question about the regional differences, and I know the Guidelines Commission has got a lot of data about that. You'd be surprised how different it is between the 8th Judicial District, where Candiahuy County is, and the 5th Judicial District, where Martin and Jackson counties are. Those counties aren't all that different, but the differences in sentencing are enormous. And I hope you save that question until the Guidelines people come with their – they got a great PowerPoint, and you'll be shocked.
Ms. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Hossie or – I'm sorry.
I'm John Stewart, sir.
John Stewart, sorry. Mr. Stewart, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with your analogy when you equate someone being arrested with 10 grams of cocaine versus someone that's arrested with for manslaughter. Someone who sells cocaine to kids, they're going to sell it to whoever for whatever price they can get. I'm going to have to disagree. I think that is a violent crime because there's no discretion as to who they sell it to and what effect it's going to have on their bodies. I just wanted to make that note for the council or for the committee. Thank you.
Representative Slocum had a quick question. Then we're.
It's going to be so quick.
No, see, I'm holding this together.
Thank you. It'll be very quick. Mr. Stewart is the father of one of my former students, one of the most awesome kids I've ever had. She's got to be in college now. Wonderful. Also, I want to do a quick shout-out to Judge Alexander, who I'm a teacher in Minneapolis, and I'm aware of the wonderful volunteer work you've done with young women, and particularly African-American women, and you've made a great impact on a number of kids that I know of. So I just wanted to do a quick shout-out on her volunteer work. Nice ending, huh?
Very good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slocum, thank you. She's doing great. She's a junior at McAllister right now.
Thank you for all of your testimony. Can I just say one thing about next week, just so you know, that you know, we're hearing all of the gun control bills. We'll be hearing as many as we possibly can next week. So during our hearing time, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we'll be hearing bills. We'll have some long evenings because we will recess at 6 and hear for public testimony, recess until 6 after to hear public testimony, because there is no way we're going to be able to accomplish all of that during our hearing time. And on Wednesday night is the State of the State address, so we won't be hearing any testimony. Does that make sense? So trying to give everyone an opportunity to have their bills heard during that period of time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schoen.
Representative Corner stated that he was going to cater the evening session,
yes,
on Tuesday from Mancini's.
You like wild food.
Representative Corner.
Chair, when are we going to do BCA?
As soon as that week is over, we're going to bring BCA in here, and we'll have a whole day on BCA, and we're having a tour of the BCA also. Okay. Representative Hossie, did you want to say one final thing?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure everybody knew that we are a resource for you all. So if you, our studies are on our website, crimeandjustice.org. We can find other resources. You know, we just want you to look at all the facts and get all the best information. So we stand ready to help you with any of that.
Appreciate all the testimony, and especially Judge for coming, Ms. Rulin, Mr. Frazee, very interesting. And we'll have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission here at another time. This meeting's adjourned. Thank you.